Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Dr. Wonders.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jake.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1958 Alfred Hitchcock classic Vertigo. Now, I told you when you had never seen this movie before, is that right?
I have never seen this movie before.
Okay.
I have seen parts of it, but I've never seen it in its entirety from start to finish.
And you've seen it lampooned in High Anxiety.
I've seen parts of this movie ripped off in probably 100 different movies. I mean, I'm sure that the filmmakers will say it was homage, or it was tribute, or it was flattery. But this movie, parts of this movie were stolen over and over again, including the score, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a technically great movie. The problem I had, granted, only the first two times I watched it. Well, okay, I do have a problem with a little bit with the pacing in the middle, but we'll get there. But
can I guess? I wrote down a couple guesses.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
So, question. Does Eric hate this because it seems like it's just one big car ad, or because he's preying on someone with mental illness?
Well, no, it's just that, I mean, yeah, there are those things, but I didn't like it at first, and I may be, my affection may be growing for the movie, because now I realize that it's actually all on purpose, but... Definitely the first two times I saw it, and then the third and fourth time I saw it, which was yesterday and today, because I just needed to get some things straight, and one of which is, spoilers, there is no happy ending in this movie. And Jimmy Stewart's character takes a turn and never comes back from that turn.
Yeah.
And that's what I didn't like about it. I just left me feeling like, oh, this is just bad. There's no happy ending for anybody.
He's a terrible man. He makes terrible choices and he pays for them.
I guess. Or he's just horribly broken and isn't ever going to get better.
Well, he may have been horribly broken, but he chose to continue that path.
Yeah, it's not an uplifting movie.
Well, but, okay. And yes, I would agree with you. It was not a happy ending, but it was a great movie.
Oh, so you liked it. At least that's a good thing.
I did. I enjoyed it very much. And you're right, but there wasn't really anybody who was really overly likable in this movie.
Oh, I disagree.
You like Midge?
Of course I like Midge.
She had her flaws, though.
Well, so, of course.
Also, she seemed to be crazy.
Everybody in this movie is crazy. Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
To a degree... Yeah. That kind of varies, but everybody in this movie is crazy. Yeah, this movie is about being crazy and being haunted.
Yeah.
Because
and all the costumes were by Edith Head, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, costumes by Edith Head. But Bernard Herrmann did the score. Saul Bass did the titles. I mean, it's fantastic.
And it was a long intro opening, and it was cool.
Yeah.
Especially considering it was 58. It was pretty awesome.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Saul Bass. Saul Bass is a designer, among other things. And he actually directed my favorite ant horror movie called Phase 4. But by being a film director, but also he did titles for a whole bunch of films. You can just look up Saul Bass titles. And you'll go to a website called The Art of Titles. And it shows like a dozen movies that he did titles for. He also did commercial art. He designed logos for businesses, including AT&T, United Airlines, the Girl Scouts, the Boys Club, Minolta, Geffen Records, Avery Labels, Warner Communications, and Lowry's Foods. And the average lifespan of a Saul Bass logo you know, before they switched to a more modern design, mm-hmm. is 34 years.
Wow.
I mean, Minolta, Avery, Geffen, Warners, and Lowry's, and the Boy Scouts are pretty much, or and the Girl Scouts too, actually, are pretty much exactly the same. AT&T upgraded a couple years ago, and United upgraded a little bit, but he designed the original logos, and they're amazing. Just from a design standpoint. So putting together all those titles, and he's of course responsible for the titles in Psycho and a couple other Alfred Hitchcock movies too. Like, all these things were done before they had the CG.
Oh, yeah.
So these are real, like, spirographic images.
No, I thought cinematically it was gorgeous. It was very well done.
Yeah.
And for being 58 and the, you know, special effects being what they were, I thought this movie held up really well.
No, I did. I do have a little bit of problem in the very opening of this movie with the fact that Jimmy Stewart survives his rooftop encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't explain how he survived, and it seems very unlikely he would have survived that.
Yeah, especially if the other guy died.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that truly is, even if you don't have acrophobia, that was a, I mean, you know, it's San Francisco, so everything is steep and tall, and he fell, like, what, 30 or 40 feet probably to his death.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would have been harrowing.
But that also begs the question, like, what kind of idiot would run roof to roof? I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, it depends on who they were chasing, too. If the guy is like a purse snatcher, let him go. You will catch up with him later. If the guy's a murderer, yeah. Which I hope he was a murderer because the other guy shot at him a couple times. Obviously, from a tactical standpoint, you don't risk your police officers to catch the bad guy, you know, or you risk them as little as possible, and going from rooftop to rooftop seems like a bad idea.
And I know we're jumping way ahead, but it just seemed to me, and this is the one thing that bothered me, and so I do, there were some flaws in the movie, but didn't it seem like, it just seemed like he was way too old to be going after Midge and company.
Well, he and Midge were peers. They went to college together. But he and Madeline was 26, right? And he was like 46 or 49 at the time.
Yeah, but Midge didn't look 46 or 49. She looked about same age as Madeline.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it just seemed like he was this disproportionately dirty old man.
A little bit, yeah.
So,
which again, when he was dirty old man, but, you know, he was kind of a rogue in the very beginning. Because I think it's the tone shift that irritates me. And shall we just dive into the plot?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and by the way, this is a legendary movie. So you guys should all watch it. We should all watch it. It's a piece of history, and it's in the top 10 of a lot of different film academies' lists of best movies ever. So that says something. And a lot of people think the things that I find flawed about the story are the best points in the story. The more, you know, it makes the story much more poignant, but we'll get there. So the plot is this. We open with a great title sequence, followed by a criminal running across the rooftops of San Francisco, being followed by a uniformed police officer and a detective. Happens to be Detective John Scotty Ferguson, played by James Stewart. And as they're leaping from one rooftop to another, Scotty slips and ends up dangling from this metal gutter off of this tall building. And the uniformed officer turns and tries to help him. And because, you know, Scotty has now looked down. And this is, by the way, a revolutionary camera technique where you zoom out and track in at the same time. I think it's called a trombone shot.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, no, literally. Yeah. So that's how they made that effect of giving him, like, the vertigo where things are kind of going wonky. So he's completely scared, and as well he should be, by the way. And his friend comes to his aid, but ends up falling to his death. The uniformed police officer falls to his death. And Scotty is just dangling. You then flash to Scotty at the apartment of his ex-fiancée, Midge, played by the lovely Barbara Bel-Geddes. of Dallas fame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's certainly fetching this role.
Looking as vibrant as ever.
Oh, yeah. I think she wins over Kim Novak every day, I think.
I would agree.
So
they made her up to be fugly, though.
A little bit. They put those goofy glasses on her. But to me, it just made her, mm-hmm. it gave her the cuteness of Velma.
Kind of, a little bit.
Yeah, she definitely in that portrait later, she looks a lot of Velma in there.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that.
But, oh, and Velma is fetching. Mm.
That's all I can see Scooby's now, next. Except Velma's a lesbian.
Oh, not necessarily. There's a whole storyline where she's not.
Oh, Daphne and Velma, get over it.
Oh, Daphne and Velma are not. No, Daphne's not a lesbian. I mean, she probably dabbles, I mean, in college and whatnot. Anyway, mm-hmm. that's for a whole different podcast.
Sure. Six Flags.
That's Mr. Midge to you, buddy. So, Scotty and Midge, even though they're ex-fianced, they, you know, Midge is kind of flirty, and Scotty is kind of flirty, and they're friends. So they have this nice rapport. And the thing about Jimmy Stewart is he's got the Jimmy Stewartness of, you know, even he's a little bit racy because, of course, Midge, what she do, she works as a commercial artist where she's basically doing ads for things like brassieres.
What's this doohickey?
It's a brassiere. You know about those things. You're a big boy now.
I've never run across one like that.
It's brand new. Revolutionary uplift. No shoulder straps, no back straps, but does everything a brassiere should do. Works on the principle of the cantilever bridge.
Does?
Mm-hmm. An aircraft engineer down the peninsula designed it. He worked it out in his spare time.
Kind of a hobby. Do-it-yourself type of thing. How's your love life, Midge?
It's following a train of thought.
Well?
Normal.
Aren't you ever going to get married?
You know there's only one man in the world for me, Johnny O.
You mean me? We were engaged once, though, weren't we?
3 whole weeks.
Yeah, good old college days. But you were the one that called off the engagement, you remember? I'm still available. Available Ferguson.
This guy's like, kind of a hobby, a do-it-yourself kind of thing. Yeah, so it's a little naughty, but, you know. So they get to chit-chatting, and Scotty asks if she remembers an old college acquaintance, Gavin Elster, played by Tom Helmore. And he has just contacted Scotty.
Had a call from Gavin today. It's funny, he sort of dropped out of sight during the war. Somebody said he went east. I guess he's back. Mission number.
Well, that's Skid Row, isn't it?
That could be.
He's probably on the bum and wants to touch you for the price of a drink.
Well, I'm on the bum. I'll buy him a couple of drinks and tell him my troubles. But not tonight. How about you and me going out for beers?
Mm-mm. Sorry, old man. Work.
Well, then I think I'll go home.
So, so he tells us he's going to meet with Gavin. Then he does this little thing where he's going to, you know, she makes a comment that she talked to her doctor about his acrophobia and said that it's not likely to be cured ever. And he's like, oh, I think I can lick it. And he does this cute little routine where he stands on progressively higher chairs until he realizes that, you know, he can't. He's still, once he gets to the top of the stair where he can look down off of her window down into the street below, and he has a panic attack and that ends that.
He had one of those step stools that we had as a in the pantry growing up.
Oh, yeah. It's like a classic sort of 50s style.
Mm-hmm. With the pull-out step stool.
Yep. Great stuff. So this is where the movie starts to get a little weird, because Scotty goes to visit Gavin, and they catch up a little bit. And, you know, so Scotty's a retired detective, and Gavin wants to hire him to follow his wife, whose name is Madeline. And Gavin believes that Madeline is possessed by the spirit of her great-grandmother, Carlotta Valdez. We learn this over the course of like a half an hour. We learn this. Later, we learn that Carlotta committed suicide at age 26, which is Madeline's current age, and he's afraid that Madeline has suicidal tendencies too. So he wants Scotty to keep an eye on her. And Scotty initially is like, you need to maybe take her to a shrink or just a GP, and maybe you should follow her in, you know? But he realizes he's being a little rude and flippant. So he's like, okay, fine. And so Gavin's like, come on, you know, go to this hotel bar, or no, go to this restaurant, and you can get a look at her, and then you can tailor from there or whatever. So that's when he sees her, and instantly he's smitten. But she's kind of fetching, if a little cold. I found her very cold, and I mean, I realize her wardrobe and her hairstyle was uptight on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, it was a conscious choice to make her kind of aloof and cold and distant and crazy.
And bound up. Because when we find the twist later, there's some unbinding.
Overwrought, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And crazy as a bedbug. So,
what does that mean, by the way?
I have no idea. So anyway, so Scotty ends up following her. And as you pointed out, it's funny because I'm not a car guy, but it certainly made me curious, so I had to look it up. And Scotty is driving a white 56 DeSoto Firedome Sportsman hardtop coupe.
I had to look it up because that was driving me crazy what the car was.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I recognized that it had a Jaguar on Madeline's hood ornament. But Madeline is driving a green 57 Jaguar Mark 8. And later we see Midge driving a 56 gray Volkswagen Karmann Ghia coupe. So everybody's in well-appointed vehicles. And we have a half an hour of Scotty following Madeline around, not talking, just driving. Driving,
well,
walking, driving, peering around corners, driving some more, following as close as you could possibly get to somebody.
And I knew when I was watching this, I that's why I said, I figured that you had a problem with all the driving. And I actually wrote down a lot of driving around or spending time in cars in this movie.
Well, and I realized that, yeah, you know, 57 years later, because that's how long it's been, you know, they've made advances in filmmaking. We talked about this with James Bond, where James Bond walks around a lot in Dr. No. Yeah, you don't have to actually drive in real time in movies anymore. It seemed like Scotty was just driving around town in real time. But that still, it, you know, because it's an interesting mystery at this point, because you don't know what's going on. It's like, who, it could be a ghost story, because you're kind of, every clue is leading you to believe that, okay, well, maybe she is possessed by this great grandmother thingy. So one of the places she goes is an art gallery where there's a picture of Carlotta, and she wants to, Scotty goes to Midge and wants to know who like the local historian is. And she says, oh, we'll have to go see Pop Bible down at the Argosy bookstore. So they run on down to the bookstore. Remember the quaint days of the bookstores. And talk to local historian Pop. And then where we learn about the sad Carlotta. And then the mad Carlotta.
I had some problems with this character because he certainly knew a whole crap load of detail about everything, except he couldn't remember the name.
Well, you know.
But I want to back up just a little bit. So earlier when first in Midge's apartment and Scotty's talking about things and she's heavy on the backstory, she's like, you know, Madame Exposition.
Oh, definitely.
And he mentions that he's a lawyer that became the police chief.
No, not a police chief, a police detective.
Right, but no, well, his goal was
to be. His goal, yes.
Right. His goal was to be, you know, a lawyer so that he could become the police chief. That seemed like a long way to go.
Well, not necessarily. I actually work with an officer, at least one, probably more than one, but at least one officer who was a lawyer before he became a police officer and now has been a police officer for probably 15 years.
Yeah, but I mean, do you go and be a lawyer thinking, hey, as a lawyer, I'm just going to go be, my goal is to become a cop after being a lawyer?
Well, that's a good question, because especially in 1958, I think that would have been, it would be, I guess, an idea if you wanted to become some sort of police administrator or higher up. Because frankly, and again, I don't know enough of my police history to pinpoint these dates. But traditionally, policemen were not hired because of their education. They were hired because they were big and could break up a bar fight.
Yeah.
So
I get that.
But of course, Scotty isn't one of those guys. So he's a smart guy. He's a detective. It works out. But yeah, no, you're right. She was Madame Exposition. And it seems like, and again, you know, this is it's easy to take in all of one's experiences, but it seems like he is needlessly dismissive while being flirty with Midge. Like his flirtiness is on a different level than hers is. Although we never learn why she broke off the engagement after 3 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, that was another big mystery.
Also, you know, she's actually, you know, for 1958, she's actually a pretty progressive woman. I mean, she obviously went to college and she's a commercial artist who works out of her home and she's very talented. And, you know, maybe that's more common in San Francisco at that time. But yeah, she's not going to be Susie Homemaker.
She lived on her own. She had her own car. She had her own apartment. She didn't need a man. She was just fine on her own. I mean, she was kind of the contemporary, I am woman, hear me roar. It's, you know, and you felt like she was put together up until the point where she's like this crazy bitch. But
oh, I don't think she became a crazy bitch, but we'll get there. She became a little crazy, but she was, I don't think she was all that bitchy. Although we're gonna argue about that, I think, too, maybe.
Yeah.
So anyway, they discover that this hotel that Madeline visits is of Carlotta's former home. Now, just to keep us up to speed, Madeline is Carlotta's great-granddaughter and is being possessed by her. And Carlotta killed herself at age 26, and so that's what Madeline is going to do, presumably. So the next day, Scotty is trailing Madeline, and this time she drives to a spot under the Golden Gate Bridge, and she throws herself into San Francisco Bay. And Scotty dives in and rescues her and drives her to his apartment. This is where the movie starts to get a little creepy.
Yeah, I wrote down, like, after a dunk in the bay, shouldn't you take that person to the hospital?
Yes, exactly. Straight away. Or maybe home, since you know where she lives.
Yeah. Also, shouldn't maybe the husband be notified?
Or why don't you call your buddy Midge so that at least Midge is in the room, or Midge can undress the lady before she wakes up in your bed naked because you disrobed her by yourself at, you know.
Should have called him Detective Date Rapey.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, Detective Cosby. So, because she wakes up and doesn't remember or claims not to remember anything about her suicide attempt. So she just appears to just wake up in a stranger's bed naked.
Detective Roofie.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like Jell-O pudding. So, and as they talk, they begin to fall in love. Although, again, since she was such a cold fish, I didn't see her falling in love with him at this point. I saw, actually, Madeline later. Well, we'll get there. But I see her as a pretty pathetic character.
Yeah.
And not very fleshed out.
I don't know about that.
Okay, well. So, as they talk, they begin to fall in love. At least Scotty has been intrigued with her anyway. And she's cute. So she's cute and mysterious, so yum yum. And she woke up in his bed naked, so she's like, don't know where this is headed, except that, you got a phone call? I'm going to slip out. So she leaves.
Well, I think, you know, he's seizing his opportunity. Hey, I've got this mentally ill lady that I can get the moves on.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I made her naked in my bed, but when she was unconscious.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that dating technique.
Yeah. There's plenty of creepy to go around. I mean, there's a surplus of the creepy. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I guess you could do a lot of negging when she wakes up and we're wearing no clothes. Yeah. Your clothes are a mess. Yeah. Pretty big size, too. You need to lose some weight, honey. But you're still cute. So Scotty then goes to the next day to trail her. And again, we're driving in real time around San Francisco. But this time, instead of making all left turns, they make all right turns. And they drive to Scotty's house, where she's going to leave a note for him. So he tries to make the moves on her there through a little line about, we'll wander together. Well, one person can wander, but two people usually have a place they're going. Well, not necessarily. And all I can think of is Dana Carvey.
Yeah, he wants one place to go in his pants.
Exactly. He's doing the Dana Carvey routine with Katharine Hepburn. Give it a little shake.
You're a terrible person. You're a terrible person.
I'm a terrible person.
Catherine Hepburn. Did Dana Carvey really do that?
Yes. I will insert it into the podcast.
Okay. I don't doubt that he would. He did a Catherine Hepburn impression, so.
Well, that's definitely a pleasurable sensation. That's a humdinger. Would you mind squeezing it a bit? Now, don't be afraid of it. It can be your friend. Yeah, say hello. Well, hello to you, too. Yeah, just wave at it now. Just say, hi, Mr. Penis, how are you? That's good. Do you have any gum? I don't know where this is going, but we'll just keep doing it. Would you mind saluting it? Oh, hello, Johnny. Hello, Mr. Stewart. So sorry to interrupt. I just have to ask you to take it to Mulholland, if you would. Yeah, I'll take it to Mulholland, sure. You want to meet my date? Hello, ma'am. Would you two stop your jabbery? This lady's got to do. See you later, Johnny. So long, Johnny. I think she's flooded.
Oh, dear.
So, they drive to a big basin, which is a giant sequoia forest, where Madeline gets, she just, you know, before she's sort of like coy and, you know, elusive and kind of mysterious, and all we have is her weirdo husband's version of the events. But now we find that Madeline is straight up crazy and points to the places on the tree where she was born and she died. And she talks about being possessed and strange dreams about death and describes a place in her dreams that looks like Spain, which Scotty recognizes as the mission at San Juan Bautista, which is very convenient. Because, you know, I mean, it could have been Spain, right?
Could have been.
Yeah. So anyway, Scotty tells her that he can explain her strange obsession with this repressed memory of time, and if she spends time at the mission, she will cure her. But not before he goes and visits Midge, because Midge left him a message. And so Scotty shows up at Midge's house.
Hi, Johnny.
Hi.
Did you get my message?
I did indeed.
I'll get you a drink.
Okay. Since when do you go around slipping notes under men's doors?
Since I stopped being able to get them on the phone. For a man who has nothing to do, you're certainly a busy little bee. Where do you go these days?
Just wandering.
Where?
Roundabout.
Oh.
What was this desperate urge to see me?
All I said in my note was, where are you? Sound very desperate to me.
I detected a little undercurrent.
I just thought that if I gave you a drink and fed you some dinner, you'd be so grateful you'd take me to a movie.
Oh, that's fair enough. What do we talk about at dinner?
Oh, this and that.
What I've been doing?
Well, if you want to. Naturally, we won't talk about anything you don't want to talk about.
Naturally.
What have you been doing?
Wandering. What have you been doing?
Hi, Kinnear.
Oh, I've been having a wonderful time. I'm going back to my first love, painting.
Well, good for you. I always said you were wasting your time in the underwear department.
Well, that's a living. But I'm really excited about this.
What is it, still life?
No, not exactly. You want to see?
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I thought I might give it to you.
Oh.
And then she shows him the painting.
Johnny.
No, it's not funny, Mitch.
Johnny?
No.
Johnny, I just thought...
No. Let's make that movie some other night.
Johnny? Oh, Marjorie, what do you... Fool! Idiot! Stupid!
And did you think the painting was mean?
I think the painting was sad.
In what way?
It was her way of trying to indicate to him that she was interested and she wanted him to be worshiping her and after her.
Yeah, because what she has is she has painted this a recreation of the art gallery painting of Carlotta, where she has replaced her face in all of her Velma glory.
Yeah, by the way, he's got an interest in the painting because he's got an interest in Madeline, who has an interest in the painting, and so she, you know, she's trying to insert herself because, you know, she desires Scotty, even though she's tossed him away before. But clearly, not so bad is the hurt that Scotty feels that he stuck around all this time as friends. So clearly he feels something strong too.
Well, he does not like, he says it's not funny and it ruins his whole mood and his mood never recovers this entire movie.
Yeah. Well, he's a prick.
Well, I mean, he was hurt by it and I can see if she, cause to me, she was just being sassy and making, yeah, it's kind of, she was like, it definitely is a flirty thing. And by the way, I don't know who drew my name for Christmas, but I would hang that picture in my house. The Midge Carlotta picture? Definitely.
You can see who has your name.
Oh, I know. I just don't remember who has it right now.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so is he basically says, that's not funny, Midge. In fact, let's just do a movie later and or maybe never. Goodbye. And of course, Midge is like, doh!
Stupid. She dramatically overreacts. I mean, she's like, stupid.
Well, I don't see it as dramatic. I mean, I see, yes, it's dramatic, but I just think it's something that you would do if you did this sort of failed, like, flirty piece of humor that just fell flat, like a Larry Beck poem.
Yeah, but she's, like, grabbing her hair and twisting her head up, and, like, she grabs the paintbrush and trashes the painting, and it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's
just seemed disproportionate.
She's the least crazy person in this entire movie. So then the next day, Scotty tells Madeline about this, where they can visit the mission at San Juan Bautista, and he takes her there, and she recognizes it all, and then they have this scene where she professes love for Scotty, and he's like, "I love you, Madeline," and she's like, "I love you too," but it's too late.
Look, it's not fair. It's too late. It wasn't supposed to happen this way. It shouldn't have happened.
It had to happen. We're in love. That's all that counts.
Look, let me go, please. Now,
listen,
let me go.
Listen.
You believe I love you?
Yes.
And if you lose me, then you'll know I loved you and I wanted to go on loving you.
I won't lose you.
Let me go into the church alone.
Why?
So then they have one last kiss and she walks away toward the bell tower and she heads up the spiral staircase with Scotty in hot pursuit. But near the top of the tower.
Not really a spiral staircase, by the way.
Well, no, but it's, it's wooden spiral. It's a square spiral. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't make sense.
A square spiral?
Well,
did you just say that?
Yeah, okay.
It's a round square.
It kind of. But it's a coil of squares.
So first of all, every time you say mission, I think of Tori Amos in that song. So also, they had the same red stucco roof, by the way, as he slipped off of in the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the it's like the terracotta roof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's terracotta roof tiles.
Exactly.
But I'm just saying, I thought it was interesting that that they use that same roof in the opening.
Oh, yeah. It's the stairwell is very reminiscent of the alley and the colors and stuff. And, of course, they do that trombone zoom thing. So, you know, that tells you he's got the acrophobias. And
which they said like 1,000 times.
Yes. Well, no, actually, they only say it once.
No, he said acrophobia like 3 or 4 times in the beginning.
Really? Okay. Well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, so near the top of the tower, he's got his acrophobia attack and he can't continue to climb. But then we hear a wah! And then you see the body of Madeline hurtling down and crashing onto the roof below. She is dead. And so Scotty then flees. But we then cut to the next scene, which is at the coroner's inquest.
So this was this weird thing. Like, why was the coroner's inquest at the mission?
Yeah, that seems a little, maybe it was because it was the biggest building in town. That's the only thing I can think of.
And also because they had like the quote unquote jury that was there. That was just like a bunch of old men sitting in chairs.
I think that's what a coroner's jury is, though. I mean, literally, I think that's what, you know, death investigations are decided by the coroner, who, by the way, doesn't even have to be a doctor.
Yeah.
So I think.
Did you recognize the coroner?
I recognized him, but didn't write down his name, unfortunately.
His name is Henry Jones, and he was in the movie 9 to 5.
Oh, as a matter of fact, he was. Absolutely. And this is kind of the inquest is kind of a weird scene because, you know, Scotty gets sort of berated by the coroner.
Yeah. Scotty gets kind of excoriated, actually.
Yeah. It's like, you're a horrible, horrible person who only had one job. It was to follow this suicidal woman, and she ends up committing suicide. And it's because you didn't do anything. And unfortunately, the law doesn't say what to do about people who don't do anything. So, obviously, the husband is cleared of all responsibility, and Scotty is cleared kind of on a technicality, but, you know, he should feel guilty as far as the coroner is concerned, and he does feel guilty. In fact, he flips his chicken, thank you, Connie, and he has, like, an animated chicken flipping scene, like, full-on animation.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, some of it looks a lot like Creepshow, where they do the interstitials.
Yeah, it was actually pretty scary.
Oh yeah, no, it was great. I'm not saying it was bad. It really gave you the idea of like the unworldliness of inside of Scotty's brain. And then we next see Scotty at the sanatorium where he is pretty much catatonic, and Midge tries her best to tell him to chipper up, little buckaroo, and she brings in some Mozart, because that's the boy for him, but that doesn't seem to work. And a year later, he is released, and we see him wandering the streets of San Francisco, like seeing hints of Madeline everywhere. I mean, he's seeing her all over the place. He is truly not well.
Yeah, he is clearly full on breakdown.
Yes. And in the meantime, Gavin has moved to Europe or wherever. And so somebody else is hit his and Madeline's apartment and driving Madeline's green Jag. But then, in the whole big city of San Francisco, he sees one woman who looks a little bit like Madeline and follows her home.
Yeah.
He has turned into Commander Creepy now.
No, he is full. I wrote, he's full on stalker now.
Oh, he is.
Because he's following around, and then he barges into her apartment and demands info.
Oh, and will not leave. Will not let her close the door on him, even though she says several times, you need to leave. Yeah, apparently being hung up on somebody, ooh, you got it bad, she says, is okay. It's justifiable for being a weirdo, because he ends up coaxing her into going on a date with him.
Yeah. The most posh of all elegant eateries, by the way, Ernie's.
Well, so her name is Judy Barton, and she's from Kansas, and she works in a department store.
Salina, Kansas.
Yes. And by the way, Kim Novak told interviewers that while in her Judy costume, she didn't wear a bra, which was very unusual for women at that time. She said that was an element of the costuming that made her feel more comfortable as Judy than as Madeline, whose costumes were more severe and stiff. Judy also has because she's got dark hair, she also has more outlandishly painted on eyebrows. You don't think?
No. I definitely noted the painted on eyebrows. I couldn't have told you if she was wearing a bra or not if you offered me $1 million.
Well, no, it was because her body actually looked different, because instead of being in a severe suit or in a super tight dress, she was in a little more casual clothes.
Or I see. The posture and body shaping were different.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I didn't really notice that, but being that I don't stare at women a lot, it probably wasn't on my radar. I imagine that a lot of dudes that saw this movie when it came out in the 50s noticed exactly.
Well, I don't, okay. Again, it's the cantilever bridge thing. It's just a different shape. It's not a huge deal.
Yeah, but
both are attractive. Again, not, one is more comfortable.
Being a hetero guy. Yeah, but I imagine if you're a breast man, you notice that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm not really a breast man, so I, you know, again, it's one of those things where, you know, because at first I wasn't sure whether it was the same person, except, of course, it was the same actress, so hello.
Well, I thought they did a pretty good job because I wasn't sure it was the same actress at first either.
Yeah. Well, because she has a different accent, and she, again, her clothing makes her body look a little different, and she's got different color hair and different thickness and length of eyebrows and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, no, they did a good job.
Yeah. So, as soon as he cajoles a date out of her, he's going to leave and let her change her clothes, and she asks for a little bit more time. And so she begins packing a suitcase. And so she sits down and composes a letter to Scotty. In it, she says, "Dear Stalker." But she actually divulges the whole plot that she was hired by Gavin Elster to play the role of Madeline in a plot he had to murder his wife. And she revealed that she got to the top of the bell tower. Elster was waiting with the already dead body of the wife, dressed identically to Judy, which then he hurled out the window for Scotty to witness. And then she ends this letter by admitting her love for Scotty, which I guess so when she woke up naked, well, although she knew she, you know, obviously she was not in a if it was all a fake, she wasn't possessed. So she knew what was going on, but she still, I guess, had affection for him. But then she just tears up the letter and decides to go out to dinner with him because there's something about crazy stalker weirdos that makes it okay.
The girl's got to eat, and Ernie's is fab.
Well, yeah, but this is the kind of thing that led to the Black Dahlia killing. You know, you just don't go out indiscriminately, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, but she already knows him.
Well, yeah, but she knows him as a sort of an intense guy before and now showing up as a near catatonic weirdo. But you're right.
You don't think she was in on the plot, though? You don't think that... That what's his face? I forget his name.
Gavin.
You don't think that Gavin kind of clued her in and told her, "Hey, this guy's crazy."
Oh no,
and that's he's gonna fall in love with you, and you know, nah, I think she knew he was crazy, and she was playing, you know, fast and loose with the rules, and she was using her guile and cunning to get him to fall in love with her to begin with, and she fell in love back, and so now that he's back, and she's all like, her heart is a twitter with the flame of resplendent love. She wants to bring him back to the bosom of her warm embrace.
Wow. Okay, you're being way more generous. To me, it's like, it just seemed like, so like both Judy and Madeline were pretty high strung.
Yeah, like I said, maybe it was just Ernie's.
Yeah, well, again, the allure of Ernie's is almost irrepressible.
They could have gone to Bert's.
They could have. That would have been a whole different experience.
Maybe.
Doing the pigeon.
They are roommates, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah, but I bet you Bert could do the pigeon while Ernie played with the rubber ducky. That was their relationship. Anyway, not my business. You know,
we're going to so regret this one day.
No, not at all. Are you kidding? I'm already going to add doing the pigeon to the podcast, so.
Me away doing the pigeon, doing the pigeon. People may smile, but I don't mind. They'll never understand the kind of fun I find doing the pigeon. I love it doing the pigeon. It's me doing the pigeon every day. Oh boy, is that exciting!
Yeah, so now they have dinner, and but it's clear from the get-go that he only has eyes for Judy because Judy looks like Madeline.
Yeah.
And he is obsessed. So obsessed that he insists that he goes and buys her clothes and dyes her hair blonde and buys her, you know, stuff too, so that she can be identical to his dream woman.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, if she wasn't Madeline, if she wasn't truly the person who was playing Madeline, I can't imagine this being acceptable for any woman taking for that kind of behavior from a man. Because, you know, he was just so insistent. And, she, you know, at one point she's crying And he's like, it can't matter to you. It can't matter to you what you look like, even though I want you to look like this other woman that isn't you, that is you, but only you know it's you.
You're right, which is exactly like saying, okay, your looks don't matter at all to you, but they make a lot of difference to me. And that's what matters in this relationship is what I think.
Yeah, you don't need to be pretty on the inside. You just need to be pretty on the outside.
Exactly. And she is getting progressively freaked out because she knows where this is going, because she has been Madeline, as it turns out. But she decides, I guess, I mean, initially she's just freaked out like anybody would, but then she decides, well, I guess it's better to be loved by Scotty as Madeline than to not have any love at all and go back to Salina, Kansas or whatever.
Yeah.
So this is where she's decided she's just going to be in it for the long haul and submit to this bad relationship.
What I would say is it's abusive.
Oh, it is. It's completely abusive. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She, I mean, he's basically, yeah, absolutely. The next step would be to hit her around a little bit.
Yeah.
So she's going to go to work at her department store with a black eye one day because she didn't look enough like Madeline.
She already had the black eye in her soul. Words can hurt.
Well, it's better to have a black eye in the soul than a brown eye in your face. No. Anyway, so.
Six Flags.
Yeah. Anyway, so so now he's basically completed the transformation and she is now just gonna put up with this crap. But she makes a mistake. She puts on Carlotta's necklace. So Scotty knows, oh, the jig is up.
Well, except that here's my problem when he discovers that she has a necklace. There's nothing to say that there weren't like 1,000 of those necklaces at a costume jewelry shop, especially because this painting is a big to-do in this gallery right now.
Well, and presumably she does not know about Carlotta or her necklace.
Well, and even if she did, why would that be a big deal? There's a whole big deal about it in the art gallery. So big deal that there was a giant playbook that went with it.
That's true. That's true. So, yeah. But now Scotty, who has already flipped his chicken once, is now flipping it multiple times. And he's gonna take this flipping chicken out on the road.
Yeah, and I wrote at this point, oh, he's clearly nuts. If he were wrong, though, he'd be a complete psychopath.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's batshit crazy, but happens to be right. And she is she is scared. She is super scared and hysterical. And for all the right reasons. This is not. This is a dangerous spot in her domestic violence relationship, and she needs to leave, but she can't figure out how to do so.
Right, she can't find the exits. She can't get to the exits fast enough to get out of his grip. But you know what? She did a great job in acting because you felt that she was scared out of her mind.
Oh yeah, and you felt it from him too. Like I said, I didn't like it because his character was such a bad guy. I mean, broken, sure. Understandable, I suppose, but I mean, from the time he's in catatonia at about an hour in, and when we have an hour 10 left, then he's sleeping with the enemy now.
No, he's terrible before that. He's terrible from almost the near beginning.
No, I just think he's flippant from the beginning.
No, he takes her home.
Oh,
he takes her home.
No, you're right.
No. He makes a series of bad choices from the beginning of this movie, and they're all self-serving and selfish, and also contrary to what he was supposed to have been doing anyway.
Exactly.
He was supposed to have been investigating and not getting involved, and instead he got involved.
Yeah. Yeah, in a weirdo relationship.
Yeah, because and now, so that choice haunts him the rest of his lifetime because he just compounds that mistake over and over and over.
Well, and her mistake, I mean, obviously, besides being a criminal, is her mistake is then to choose this, the love of a man who she doesn't necessarily share, although in the story claims that she does. But, you know, the love of a man over her own personal safety.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know if the love is real because they have the worst stage kissing I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is the time, of course, when a passionate kiss, then next you're just going to be getting married. So, and she is actually, as it turns out, you know, she even mentions that, you know, this Salina, Kansas Judy girl, she actually gets picked up here and there. Not that she's a prostitute, but she, you know, she's willing to be picked up by a man, so that tells you something about her. She's a little cheap. She's a little bit more cheap than Madeline would be, which again is a reason why he can mold her to his will. And it's horrible. It's a horrible thing.
Yeah. No, he's a terrible guy.
And then, so then he drives her to the bell tower, and so she knows the jig is up, and he is going to drag her to the top of this tower and confront her and admits everything and begs his forgiveness. But he's not having that.
I made you over just like I made you over, only better. Not only the clothes and the hair, but the looks and the manner and the words and those beautiful phony trances. And you jumped into the bay, didn't you? I'll bet you're a wonderful swimmer, aren't you? Aren't you? Aren't you? And then what did he do? Did he train you? Did he rehearse you? Did he tell you exactly what to do, what to say? You were a very apt pupil, too, weren't you? You were a very apt pupil. But why did you pick on me? Why me? I was the setup, wasn't I? I was the setup. I was a made to order witness. I made it. I made it.
What are you going to do?
We're going up and look at the scene of the crime. Come on, Judy. Come on. And this is where it happened. And the two of you hid back there and waited for it to clear, and then you sneaked down and drove into town. Is that it? And then you were his girl, huh? Now, what happened to you? What happened to you? Did he ditch you? Oh, Judy, with all of his wife's money and all that freedom and that power, and he ditched you. What a shame. And he knew it was safe. He knew you couldn't talk. Did he give you anything?
Yes, some money.
And the necklace. Carlotta's necklace. There was where you made your mistake, Judy. You shouldn't keep souvenirs of a killing. You shouldn't have been. You shouldn't have been that sentimental. I loved you so, Madeline.
Buddy. I was safe when you found me. There was nothing that you could prove. When I saw you again, I couldn't run away. I loved you so. I walked into danger, let you change me because I loved you and I wanted you. Safe.
It's too late. It's too late. There's no bringing her back.
Please.
And then, as they're embracing, or he is holding her against her will, having conquered his acrophobia by going up to the top of the bell tower, then all of a sudden, a very inopportune arrival of a nun is like, hello, hello, honey.
You know what popped into my head?
What?
Cloris Leachman?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So Judy is so startled by the ghostly figure of a nun come walking out of the shadows that she screams and falls from the tower to her death.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're left. Okay. She is dead. Scotty is at the top of the tower and he is cured of his acrophobia. But in every other way, he is still a crazy broken person. I mean, he needs to go directly to jail.
He needs to go to jail?
Yes, he murdered Judy.
He didn't murder Judy.
He drug her against her will. He kidnapped her against her will, drug her to the top of the tower.
No,
as a result of that, startled, she died.
She was startled by the nun, and the nun startled her. He can't be held responsible for the nun startling her.
No, it's the felony murder rule. He was committing a felony, kidnapping, and she died during the commission of a felony, so he should be charged with felony murder. Thank you. The prosecution rests your turn. Begin your case, defense.
I don't know that you could. She was pretty willing to go up there, and she's willing to get the makeover. I mean, I don't know that this rises to the level of kidnapping. But
ladies and gentlemen of the jury, yeah. She was petrified. He was physically dragging her up the stairs that she did not want to go on.
But then at the top of the stairs, she professed her love and wanted an embrace.
Of course, because it was her only way out of the clutches of a madman. Who knows what he was going to do up there? Yeah, she had no, she had to do. She had to use whatever tool she had in her arsenal as base as you might think those tools are. She had to use all the tools she could to get out of this horrible situation, and yet she could not get out because the madman kept her up there until another factor came in that caused her to lose her footing or whatever. Had he not dragged her up there, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, she would not be dead today. She could join him in jail, but she would not be dead. The prosecution rests. We recommend life imprisonment in Alcatraz, Your Honor. Or what was the name of the hospital in the high anxiety?
The Institute for the Very, Very Nervous?
Yes. Yeah, he needs to be put there forever. And I guess, so you could argue that Psycho doesn't have a happy ending, except that you find out that Norman Bates is the bad guy and that he is super creepy and twisty, but at least the family of Marion Crane has the resolution to her death. You know, the cold comfort of at least figuring out what happened. But in this case, Judy doesn't have anybody. And Scotty only has Midge. And, I mean, I'm sure it's pathetic enough. Midge is going to visit him all the time at Alcatraz. She'll have to get on that ferry during all sorts of bad weather, fog and whatnot, and go over there and go on the one visit a month or whatever. And he won't appreciate it because he never appreciates Midge. She'll bake him cookies. She will bake the man cookies and he won't even appreciate it. And Gavin, let me tell you about Gavin. Do you know that they had to do for the European release of this movie, they had to tack on a little thing at the end where they hear some sort of radio thing about Gavin being arrested in Europe because you weren't allowed to have a movie where the murderer gets away with it?
What? Really?
Yeah. Like in the United States, they were called the Hays Codes. But there are lots of things like literally you could only have like if a couple was sitting on the same bed, they both had to have 1 foot on the floor.
1 foot on the floor. Yeah. I remember
but
that.
But also you couldn't have the bad guy getting away with it. You always had to show that crime was bad and the bad, you know. So if you did something bad, it was a whole morality thing.
Oh, God. How many movies wouldn't have gotten made nowadays?
Oh, yeah. No, once those were over. Well, of course, you know, the MPAA is a whole different animal that you have to fight against censorship-wise. But, yeah, the Hays Code was a serious deal. And that's why all those independent movies, because they, you know, they didn't get that that seal on there. That's where all the Grindhouse movies came from and whatnot. If I'm understanding my film history enough. Which I probably don't, because like I said, one of the things we bring to this podcast is no education, but enthusiasm.
Yeah, no research, but plenty of misinformation.
Oh, yeah, no, I research as far as Wikipedia, IMDb, and in this case...
the conjecture of your own mind.
Well, that and Spark Notes.
Spark
Notes? Which is kind of like a Cliff Notes. There's a Spark Notes about the movie Vertigo. It's just basically turning it into a classroom setting, so talking about the major themes. And, like, it was interesting to look at because even though you kind of got it while watching the movie anyway, it kind of spells out that, okay, so as it turns out, at first we think that Madeline is being possessed by Carlotta, but it turns out that's all the game. But Jimmy Stewart is actually possessed by Madeline, and then the memory of Madeline or the image of Madeline. And then Judy then also becomes possessed by Madeline because she has to be Madeline to keep Scotty around, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. Yeah, and, this is a great movie.
And Midge is possessed by Scotty, who she calls Johnny.
I did it for Johnny.
Exactly. You know, that's the other thing that happened. Midge could definitely get a gun. You could see that happening. Like, she slashed that paint with the brush. Her next step would be to get a gun.
You think?
Well, maybe. These are different times.
It's possible. The streets of San Francisco.
I'm telling you. So, you liked this movie still?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. In spite of the flaws in the plot, the story was at least it was a nice morality tale because, of course, everybody got punished. So.
Oh yeah, nobody won. That's for sure. Everybody lost.
So no, I'm fine. I'm fine with this. I thought it was, you know, scary. It was a beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh, it definitely was. It was that. It was beautifully shot. It was, you know, everything from, as you said, the score to the costuming to the cinematography. I'm sure the craft services were great.
But I do agree with you that the driving was a bit much.
Yeah.
And there was just no reason for it other than, like I said, I thought it was just a big car ad. You know, DeSoto and Jaguar must have, you know, that's product placement.
Oh, definitely.
Because it was very clear what car he was driving. I mean, had I been born in that era, I would have known what car it was. But I was looking at it, I'm like, what an odd looking car. And I couldn't make out the name on the badge on the front of the car to find out what it was. So the couple of fleeting glances I had where the name badge was on there, I was like, what is that?
But it would have been recognizable at the time. You're absolutely right.
Well, yeah, I think anybody from that generation would have.
Yep. So Vertigo. Happy Halloween, people. This will come out the week of Halloween or maybe Sunday on the week before Halloween. Maybe I'll put it out on Monday. So we have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of Not in a Creepy Podcast. Although this won't be an official Halloween because it's not really a scary movie as much as it's a tense psychological thriller.
Yeah, it's kind of a thriller.
Yeah, and, you know, now, again, having watched it a fourth time, I get it, you know. I'm just not going to feel happy at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be zen with it. Sometimes movies end and they're not a feel-good movie.
Well, I wonder if this would be different if instead of Jimmy Stewart, it was Carl Malden or, you know, Joseph Cotten or somebody in that era who was a little bit less of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, a little, you know, what is the Christmas one?
Oh, you couldn't divorce yourself from the fact that he was Goody Two Shoes guy?
Kind of, because he was so, you know, he was kind of fun.
You're saying George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life.
A little bit, because he's kind of fun. Yeah, you know, so he's in the beginning. You want to see him redeemed. And, you know, he's being flirty. He's being, he's cracking wise. Well, as soon as he goes catatonic there, he's not cracking wise no more.
That's why actors take different roles. They don't want to get pigeonholed and typecast.
I suppose. You're going to bring me down to earth with that. But you know, it did, like I said, this is not, I'm not saying this is a bad movie. I'm just saying that it's not one of my favorite Hitchcock movies because it doesn't give me that good feeling. But it did give me, even though I wanted to like somebody in this movie, it did, yeah, I felt for the characters. I mean, everybody was in a no-win situation. Except for, of course, the husband who got out just scot-free.
So this wasn't your favorite Hitchcock movie, but if you divorce yourself from that genre, that it's a Hitchcock movie, it's a film just on its own without putting the gravitas of the Hitchcock dynasty up against it, just as a standalone film, how do you feel about it?
Okay, well, let me compare it then to The Apartment.
Okay, that's a good comparison.
Well, except that The Apartment has kind of a happy ending. Everybody's still kind of in a crappy life at the end of The Apartment, but at least, you know, the people that you've kind of rooted for, you know, come out of it in one piece. And in this movie, it's like there's the only people left are broken and irreparably. Again, no one will appreciate Midge's cookies. But yeah, I mean, Midge's
cookies
that,
is slang for vagina.
That's right. Who is going to eat Midge's cookies if not Scotty? She'll never get her cookies eaten. And San Francisco seems to be the right town to get your cookies eaten at if you're a woman of a certain age in 1958.
That will be edited out.
Midge and her two friends from the underwear commercial art department they actually founded the Pleasure Chest and now run one of San Francisco's finest dildatoriums where they celebrate Anal August.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was going to say it's Cocktober.
It is Cocktober. I'm sure it is.
You know, And she can go back to school to become a dildologist.
She could. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, pull in your own mold. Oh,
God. I'm so sorry, Mom.
It's okay. She'll take all those Tristan Taramino classes on anal sex for August, and she'll take the Susie Bright courses, and she'll have it all down. Sex Nerd Sarah, we'll have it all down. It'll be fine. Midge was a pioneer. She actually was a director of Made for Women Pornography in that brief period of time when they had Made for Women Pornography. She was about 70, but still, ahead of her time.
Dear.
Yeah, really the same era as Georgina Spelvin or whatever her name was from Devil and Miss Jones. Look it up, kids. It's old porn. Okay, so anything else to add?
Wow, we went right off the bell tower with her.
Yes. But again, it does make me appreciate high anxiety a lot better.
Well, and I wrote down the beginning of this, I skipped over one of them. Oh, there is a lot of long forced perspective shots on towers, belfries, and tall buildings in this. And that was really prominent throughout this movie.
Yeah. Also, you see a lot of shots kind of up at Jimmy Stewart, making it appear really tall, which kind of gives you that same kind of perspective. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not like crazy angles, but it definitely is like upward angles.
Yeah. It seemed to be a fairly conscious effort to make you feel that in the movie, which is cool. I mean, I like that.
Well, and San Francisco was the perfect town for this because it's all up and down hills, you know, really like steep hills kind of a city in that part of town. And, you know, he had all those towers around, and it's just, yeah, it was a great setting.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep. So we should watch Chinatown. Have you seen Chinatown?
I don't think I've ever seen Chinatown.
I want to put that on the calendar sooner rather than later.
Go ahead. Arrange away.
Yeah. Well, I will. I mean, we'll leave the calendar the way it is for a bit. So send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.